produced by Jeffrey Cresselius, Preston Frazier, Bill Govier and Wayne Hall. This is Yes Music Podcast, episode 430. What Did They Do Next? Part 13A, John Anderson.
Hi, this is Alan White from Yes, and you're listening to Yes Music Podcast.
Welcome to episode 430 of the Yes Music Podcast, two fans' exploration of the world's greatest progressive rock band. I'm your host, Kevin Mulrine, and co-host Mark Anthony Kay will be along in a little bit. You can always get involved with the podcast via the various different ways on the site, yesmusicpodcast.com. This week, we turn our attention to the next person to leave the band, John Anderson. He called it a day after the Big Generator tour. So, what did he do next? Find out later on. We also have a sort of double two pence, which is concerned both with what Roger Dean is currently up to on Facebook and why it matters for fans of the recorded output of the world's greatest progressive rock band. Before all that, though, here's a quick sturge through the Yes-related interwebs for the past week. Incidentally, sturge, in the vernacular of my Belfast grandmother, means to walk with great purpose, or something like that. One for Jeff Bailey there. On the YMP Facebook page, Keith Hoisington spotted the ultimate Steve Howe interview, which is funny because I didn't think he'd decided to give up media appearances, and Daniel Crone was back with his concept for a fan-made ARW album. Interesting stuff. In this week's selection from Geoffrey Mason, here's the list. A Steve Howe interview from 1971. Rick Wakeman and the English Chamber Choir on the soundtrack to the forthcoming film Lawrence After Arabia. The Roger Dean documentary from 2002. Steve Howe interviewed in Prog Magazine's June edition. John Anderson playing a concert at the end of June, which the American Association of Retired Persons believes will be of interest to its members. A review of Open Your Eyes and The Ladder, which have been reissued by Ear Music. A prog review video about Steve Howe's book. The Rick Wakeman-backed PRS Emergency Relief Fund, which has raised over £2 million for songwriters and composers. And John Anderson on the soundtrack of his daughter Deborah's film Women of the White Buffalo. Another fantastic collection, Geoffrey. Also, in the visitor posts, Doug Curran wished the much maligned Union album a happy 29th anniversary, and Eddie Jobson a happy 65th birthday. Over on Twitter, the usual deluge of tweets were entertaining. Here are a very few highlights. Simon Barrow posted a photo from his first ever Yes concert, Empire Pool, Wembley, 28th of October 1977 on the Going for the One tour, which is fabulous, and listen out for more from Simon later on. I posted one of my latest record collection editions, or at least the serial number. Guess what album it is? And also a shot of the recording studio at YMP Towers for your delectation. Henry Potts' post about their new live Yes album was replied to by Raphael Cabello, who posted an Alan White interview from May 2020, in which he apparently says something about a new studio album in 2021. But as I can't read Spanish, I'm not exactly sure what it says. However, as I was considering this, both Emma Leach and Raphael himself took pity on me. Here's their combined translation. Alan says, "We are starting with it. There is some music already written, little. It is possible that we will start recording after summer, but until 2021 there will be no new album. I cannot specify anything else, sorry." And here's a synopsis. Recording time after the summer, record out 2021. I hope you've managed to catch Miguel Falcao's brilliant live masterclasses. Here's what he said to me this week. "Just to let you and the YMP know, I've been doing live streams on Facebook around 22 hours, 10 o'clock in the evening, that's UK time, Portugal time, about three times per week during lockdown. Most episodes are still available on my Facebook page. Last night we examined bits of Close to the Edge on fretless bass. So, how could you resist? Head over to miguelbass.com or Miguel's Facebook page for all that." In sort of stop press news, we heard from Jeff Bailey this week about an amazing project he's involved with. It's called The Prog Report Presents Prog From Home. It's going to be a virtual YouTube concert featuring a dazzling array of prog artists, including, according to the poster, Mike Portnoy, Jordan Rudess, Steve Hackett, Neil Morse, Michael Sadler, Ray Wilson, Nick Barrett, Oliver Wakeman, Nick De Virgilio, Bruce Sword, Haken, Casey McPherson, Magenta, The Reign of Kindo, and Chant, John Wesley, Paul Bielatovich, I hope that's how you pronounce it, John Mitchell, Eric Gillette, Novena, Randy McStein and Adam Holtzman, Moron Police, Dave Kirstner and Fernando Perdomo, Marbin, The Fierce and the Dead, Randy and Pamela George, and more. You're going to be able to see what it's all about on the Prog Report's own YouTube channel or progreport.com, and the event itself kicks off on the 9th of May at 11 a.m. PST, 2 p.m. EST, 7 p.m. UK time, and 8 p.m. CET. So do see if you can be there for that. And finally, in a packed section this week, not content with the great blog post about the new Steve Howe autobiography, Simon Barrow has also sent this in.
Hello, Kevin and Mark and everyone at Yes Music Podcast. Thanks very much indeed for everyone who offered positive comments on my review of Steve Howe's new autobiography, All My Yesterdays, which was published recently by Omnibus Press. My review, if you want to have a look at it, is on my website, yessolidmentalgrace.com, which is the same as the title of my book. And I thoroughly enjoyed what Steve had to say. He's not a professional writer, but he put a lot of work into it. And although it's a little dry in places, it really gives a great overview of his life and career, his time in Yes, everything that preceded that and his upbringing, his other musical adventures with the Steve Howe Trio, with Remedy, with Aisha and with quite a number of other musicians, as well as talking about his influences in the worlds of jazz and country music and classical music and some of the other things that have shaped his life, including the things he's been reading. So it's a good read, but not everyone has enjoyed it. Matthew Algio, who is an author and journalist I have a considerable respect for, wrote a rather withering piece on Medium.com in which he described it as a deeply uninteresting book. And he has a go at it in a number of ways, including criticism for the mistakes that occur in it. There are a number of those, and I do think a publisher the size of Omnibus could perhaps have served Steve a wee bit better. It's very nicely produced, but there are quite a few errors which perhaps should have been ironed out and might in a second edition, but I wouldn't let that put you off. Perhaps the kind of gap between my pretty deep appreciation of what the book represented and Matthew's very different opinion is bridged by some kind of comment about the sort of person Steve is, really. He's not someone who's immediately accessible, and perhaps that's true of the book in places as well. And I can illustrate that with an experience I had back in 1991 when I was incredibly fortunate to be able to spend an hour talking to Steve about the new album he'd produced at the time called Turbulence, which is a collection of instrumentals that features Bill Bruford on drums and Billy Curry, ex-Ultravox keyboardist, and a couple of other collaborators as well. But it's largely Steve's rock instrumentals with a progressive feel to them. And Relativity Records put it out. Sadly, they're no longer with us. But they set up a series of interviews, so I went to a little place above a barber shop in the Fulham Road, if I remember correctly. And it was a fascinating interview. I really, really enjoyed talking to Steve. But I suppose it was how it began that gave you some kind of insight into what he's like, a very particular kind of person. He was incredibly anxious because he thought there was a strange buzzing noise in the room and he couldn't figure out what it was. So literally, he and I spent probably 5 minutes crawling around the floor trying to find out what the source of this noise was. And then, of course, it occurred to me that we were above a barber shop, so there would be electric razors and other things. As soon as I mentioned that, there was some element of relief in him, but he was still a little bit edgy, had a glass of water, didn't want that, called the A&R guy back and got a glass of orange juice. We began to talk about Turbulence, and then because no one else was coming through, he was very happy to spend more time chatting with me, and it developed into a lengthy conversation about music and about Yes and about all the things that had shaped his love of the guitar. I really, really enjoyed it. I published some of it, but I've still got some of it which perhaps I will published somewhere else, maybe on my website at some point. But it really, the sort of balance between Steve Howe, the very private person, and Steve Howe, the public musician, came across to me in that experience, and it comes across to me in the book as well. So I hope you'll read Steve's autobiography. I think if you're a fan of Yes, you will enjoy it. Also, don't forget to read Bill Bruford's autobiography, which is enormously insightful and interesting and extremely well written, and revolves around the curious questions that he was asked throughout his lengthy musical career. There's also, of course, Rick Wakeman's little book Say Yes, which is perhaps more of a celebrity potboiler, and Pete Banks, the original guitarist of Yes, teamed up with Billy James to write a book about his experiences and the early years of Yes, which is worth getting. And then I think many of us are hoping that the interviews Chris Squire did with Vincent Gallo back in 2012-2013 might lead to a book at some point. Vincent has indicated that that could be a possibility. We'd really like to read that, and I'm sure there are others associated with the band who will be coming out with their reflections and memoirs over the years, as well as, we hope, contributing to some great music. So enjoy Steve's book, and best wishes to all.
Thanks to Simon for those words. I'm still only about a quarter of the way through the book myself, and thank you to everyone who's been in touch this week.
This is Miguel Falcão at miguelbass.com. You are listening to the Yes Music Podcast. Established in 2011, this is Two Fans' exploration of the world's greatest progressive rock band.
So amidst lockdown still, Mark is here with me now. Hello, Mark.
Hello there, Kevin. How are you doing?
Not too bad. What about you?
Oh, very good, very good. Keeping healthy and pursuing my musical endeavors at home, mm-hmm. in you know, as usual. But, you know, now that I have to be in here full time, you know, I'm getting a lot more done, it seems.
Mm. Well, excellent. That's something anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
So we're here to talk about the next person to have left the band. And this time it's after the Big Generator tour, and it's John Anderson. So what did he do next? But before we go on to exactly what he did do next, let's think about Big Generator itself. And clearly it was a hugely difficult thing to do, to follow up 90125. And I read earlier, and I've got some things to read out in a minute about the end of that, but I know that Trevor Rabin particularly was very worried about having to follow up Owner of a Lonely Heart. I think he was told directly by the record company, you must have another huge hit on this album. And it certainly wasn't an easy thing to do, was it? Record, write, get this thing done.
Yeah, I mean, and it doesn't help when the suit guys come up to you and start saying, excuse me there, Mr. Rabin, we would like you to repeat what you did on the prior record. It's just, you know, musicians don't work well with like that, you know, right, under pressure, you know. Some do, some don't. And I mean, John Anderson himself has said several times that even as far back as, you know, Fragile, when they did Roundabout, that they were kind of being, you know, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, how about another one of those roundabouts? And he's like, no, we're not going to do that.
No, indeed. And there were all sorts of stories, weren't there, about the problems getting this done. So they went to Italy, into that chateau or whatever you call it in Italy, the big house. And then Trevor Horn left. He seemed to be clashing with Tony Kaye and various others. And then they went to Los Angeles, and Paul De Villiers took over the production. And I think Trevor Horn did a lot of the production and mixing and so on himself. So, I think Chris Squire, I remember when we discussed this previously, was of the opinion that they just didn't have any ideas. So just turning up at a beautiful Italian location, but with no ideas for songs, doesn't work.
Yeah. And this also is a great example. Children, if you're listening and you're, you know, want that dream of being a musician, never make this mistake. When you make money and you have success, don't blow it all on stupid things like, let's go to Italy and record, when you could be just, you know, in your hometown in a good studio and record a good record. You know, why blow thousands of dollars just to go to some chateau and you don't end up even making anything because you're too busy going to restaurants and this and that and not even focusing on it?
No, absolutely. That certainly seems to be what happened. So John Anderson, then, that's who we're focusing on today. John Anderson was clearly becoming disillusioned. So if you remember the wonderful episode we did about cinema, he only came into at the last moment and then it turned into Yes and all that. So 90125, I think he really had less to do with 90125 than perhaps any Yes album before. And he was getting frustrated with that kind of the direction of the band and really not being able to control himself the direction of the band, I think. So after the terrible experience of Big Generator, perhaps it wasn't that surprising that he decided the time was up for him in Yes.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a surprise, is it? Because, I mean, John Anderson always seems to be one of these people that likes to have things kind of go his way or the highway, you know what I mean? So, I find it interesting, though, because even in the 90125 documentary that was done on the DVD there, he mentions that the band used to complain about him being too controlling back in the 70s. And then he said in that interview that he decided not to do that after that ever again. But it seems like he just can't seem to shake that feeling, can he, that he has to be in some sort of control with it. But I mean, look, he has his, you know, his trademark, his, you know, fingerprints all over this record. I mean, Holy Lamb. I mean, how much more of a John Anderson song can you get than that? Yeah, you know, and there are other things on this record where he's obviously involved.
Yes, yes. And it's one of those records that certainly I find every time I come back to it that I enjoy it a lot more than I remember doing so. But if you think about the tour, now the tour for Big Generator only went to North America and Japan. So it was nothing like the 90125 tour. But then again, how are you going to match or beat the 90125 tour? It was just epic and all over the world and went on for such a long time. But perhaps the whole band maybe were battered by the recording process and then touring as well. And perhaps everyone was feeling a bit disillusioned at that point.
Yeah, I mean, when you do a huge record like 90125, you know, the label's going to be putting you all over the place to go to support it, because, you know, the more you play and the more you tour, the more money is generated, the more records that are sold, so on and so forth. Now they go and make a record, took forever to do it. I mean, Alan White said that he had finished the drum tracks and then it took 18 months after that that they completed the record. Like, it took forever to finish the record. After that, you go out on tour again.
Yeah.
So, of course, you're going to be, like, now exhausted. But you got to remember one thing, though, too. That tour did pretty well. I mean, I have a couple of bootleg videos and shows. And there was a show that I have of them in Philadelphia playing for the Big Generator tour. And they had, like, 15-minute standing ovations after songs, like Heart of the Sunrise and stuff like that. So they were doing well still.
Yes, indeed. And the record itself sold over 1 million copies, I understand. So certainly they weren't at a low ebb commercially, I suppose, but certainly the discontent was clear. And I'm just going to read what our friend Dave Watkinson says about it in his book Perpetual Change. He says, the success of Trevor Rabin's singer-songwriter skills had seen John Anderson's dominant role as the frontman gradually reduced over the last 4 years, and he realised he just wasn't enjoying himself anymore. Moreover, it was reported that he felt he lacked the control, as I just said, he once had, and was further disenchanted with accountants and management making crucial decisions on the band's future and musical output. All of this was compounded by John and Chris suffering personal problems that had built up over the years, the fraught recording sessions for Big Generator, and its long, arduous corresponding tour. Everything had taken its toll on John, and disillusioned at the end of the tour, he decided to leave the band for the second time. And this is what John Anderson said. I enjoyed working with the guys on the last couple of albums very much. My participation was very strong. He always says that, doesn't he? Yes. My participation was very strong. It was just one of those things. You feel a turning point in your career. I wanted to make something more of an experience in music, a continuum of what I believe, really. I wasn't really creating that with Trevor and the guys. So that's interesting, isn't it? So he wanted to go off and create something. It sounds like he wanted to create something more epic, more exciting, moving in new and different directions. So that'll be interesting when we come along to talk about what he actually did do next in that context. But there's a little bit also in Chris Welch's Close to the Edge, the story of Yes, that I wanted to read out as well. And he says, John Anderson believed that his opinions about the attempt to make Yes a commercial hit machine with Big Generator had been vindicated. In any case, he had become increasingly unhappy with his role in the band. He said, "It was though I'd been pigeonholed just to be happy to be the singer in the band. Get your check and don't make waves. Okay, so you don't want to hear what I have to say. So what am I doing in the band?" Mm. So the last concert that they played was the Atlantic 40th anniversary concert. And after that, he went a different way, leaving the whole ABWH and Yes West thing to kick off. But so this is where I get a bit confused by this, because the album that we're going to listen to over this week and then talk about next week is called In the City of Angels. And so John was completely in control of this. And I think, in fact, he started working on this before he left Yes, but it was certainly the first thing that he did that he released after leaving. And clearly he was unhappy with this sort of commercialization of Yes. So what you might have thought is that he would go off in some bizarre, esoteric-type direction straight away. Not my recollection of the parts of this album. I haven't heard all of it. That I've heard. Would that be your recollection?
You took the words right out of my mouth, because I was thinking the same thing too. I mean, if you think about all the reasons why he leaves, you know, so you're thinking, okay, he's going to make something maybe not like as odd as Elias of Sun Hilo, because after all, this is the 80s going into the 90s soon. So, you know, you want to be with the times of it, but you know, something a little bit more adventurous he's going to make, or something more musically diverse. But from what I remember as well, because I don't have this record. This record's eluded me. Every time I go to the record store, I see it there. And it's always kind of saying, buy me, buy me, buy me. And I don't ever end up buying it, because I'm like, it's always here. I'll buy it when I get a chance. So I haven't bought it, but I've heard several songs off of it. And I always have to kind of slap my forehead when I hear them, because I'm like, this is what you left Yes for. This is what it is. Absolutely a commercial pop record. I'm convinced of it.
Absolutely. And, you know, like the Thousand Hands idea, he's got a huge number of people playing on it. And particularly, I hadn't realized this until I read up about it a little bit before this episode. Practically the whole of Toto are on this record. Okay. And a lot of people think that this is much more like a Toto album than even a John Anderson solo album. So, I mean, if I just run down some of the names on this. So John Anderson clearly plays the harp and the drums and percussion and vocals. But then you've got, so here we go, Steve Luthaker, Steve Porcaro, Jeff Porcaro, Mike Porcaro, David Paich, who does orchestration and so on. And then it goes on and on, Joseph Williams, Larry Williams, John Robinson, Paul Jackson Jr., Jimmy Haislip, just goes on and on. I'm not going to read them all out. And ends with, quite amusingly, the Cathedral Choir doing backing vocals on track 11. So certainly this is no surprise if you know John's work. He loves to do this. He loves to cram the place with as many musicians as he possibly can. And that sometimes works brilliantly, of course. There are lots of bits on Thousand Hands that I think are excellent for it. And, for example, his collaboration with the string orchestra, was it the English string orchestra? I don't know, can't remember now, on Change We Must, I think, is brilliant.
Yeah.
So you know, it's got to put you in a certain mood, hasn't it, when you realise that there are almost hundreds of musicians, and possibly with the choir, there are hundreds of musicians on this album.
Yeah, I mean, and that makes it less of a John Anderson solo record. I mean, the only thing that kind of surprised me is that they didn't include Grandma and Grandpa Porcaro as well on there, or the house, or you know, the maid Porcaro of the Porcaro household, or you know, the dog didn't make a special guest appearance from the Precaro family as well. So, you know, it's just interesting that how much of Toto was actually on this, you know, and also like the songwriting, the songwriters that he like wrote with. I mean, he wrote with some Motown guy too, right? Lamont Dozier or something like that.
Yeah.
He's a known Motown songwriter, and
right,
I mean,
right,
he's obviously very good at that kind of songwriting. But I mean, you know, again, I ask you, Kevin, is this really why you leave Yes for a record like this?
Yeah. Well, I mean, looking at it, Hold On to Love. Now, I think that was a single, wasn't it? That's the first,
yes,
the first song on there, and 4 minutes 46 of that. And then there are lots of other ones, and you've got typical John titles like If It Wasn't for Love, brackets Oneness Family, and then Sun Dancing for the Hopi / Navajo Energy, In a Lifetime, For You, It's on Fire, Top of the World, The Glass Bead Game, whatever that is. And then the last one is Hurry Home. Now, this is something that he's done several versions over the years of this Hurry Home song, and it's one I really like. So interested to hear what that's going to be like. But definitely that single, I've seen even the video to that single, which is such an 80s pop video. It's remarkable. But, you know, we're not prejudging this. We're going to listen to it properly and see what we think. But what does sound very strange is as you say, is the comparison between I'm leaving Yes because of the direction it's going, but I'm going to put out a pure pop album as my antidote to that Yes idea. And just looking at the chart positions of this record, it really didn't do very well. In fact, the only one that Wikipedia can find to put on their article is 1988, position 33 of the Dutch albums chart. So,
well, there you go.
Didn't really trouble the record buying public.
No, but the good old Dutch come through again for John, right? So that at least that, right? I mean, at least he can justify it with that, right? But I mean, I guess we'll hear more in detail when we both listen to it if our criticisms are, you know, justified or not. But it is interesting here, and you there's a video for this Hold On to Love. I haven't seen it, but I'm going to definitely go and seek it out now, because according to, you know, Wikipedia here, it says that Chris Squire has a cameo appearance in the video as an acoustic bass player. So I want to see that.
Yes, indeed. Yes, I have seen it, and I have seen Chris who pops up. And that's fascinating, isn't it? Because how did that came about? If you listening know how that came about, I'd be fascinated to hear it, because having just left Yes, what's he doing there coming onto a video for John's record? Oh, well.
It always seems interesting that those two always seem to have some sort of eternal bond that never really broke. You know what I mean? Even whenever they leave, you know. And I mean, that's interesting too. I mean, we're getting a little off topic here, but just really quickly, remember when we were talking about ABWH and the formation of it, that Steve Howe mentioned to John Anderson about, you know, recreating this ABWH band. He says, do you want Chris Squire in it? And John Anderson initially said that he wanted him in there, but Steve Howe didn't.
Yeah.
So there you go. Even at that time, he always wanted Chris around.
Interesting, isn't it? Okay. Well, I'm looking forward very much to hearing that record this week, the whole of it. And we will come back next week and give our considered opinions on it. But for the moment, thank you very much indeed, Mark.
You're very welcome, Kevin.
This is Two Pence with Mark Anthony Kay and Kevin Mulrein.
So we're still here for our Two Pence. Welcome back, Mark.
Thank you very much, Kevin. Good to be back.
Okay, so let's talk about something which is going on. So there are two parts to this Two Pence. The first part is an incredibly positive one, because if you've managed to catch them so far, Roger Dean has been doing live painting sessions with hilariously, actually, Freya Dean, his daughter, trying to work the cameras. And they've improved everything, and they've got their internet connection up and running properly. And it's been a bit of a struggle, I think, but absolutely brilliant. And she's fielding the questions and feeding them through to Roger to answer as he does this this work in progress stuff, which is absolutely brilliant. But the part of it which I, you know, gave me a sort of second take or whatever you want to call it, was that he let slip. And I don't know if this, if he was supposed to actually let this slip, but because this is the first I'd ever heard of this, he let slip that the painting he was going to be working on was for the new Yes album. And so I, with everybody else, of course, got very excited. New Yes album, that's fantastic. So this new studio album is definitely happening then. But no, this is the Royal Affair live tour album. So on the one hand, we've got this fantastic insight into Roger Dean's work, how he puts something together from scratch. And, you know, he's drawing with pencil and all the development drawings are just fantastic already. And he's only on the fourth episode, I suppose, of this so far. So that's incredibly positive. On the other hand, here we are again, Mark, doing a twopence about another Yes live album. Now, you went to the Royal Affair tour, so you should have some pretty hefty insights into this.
Yes. On one hand, you know, you kind of get excited when you get to have a live album from a tour that you've seen, right? I mean, I know everybody's like that, you know, oh, I went to this tour and they made a live album from it, yay. You know, like, that reaction is kind of normal, I think.
Yeah.
But, you know, as we've mentioned, or as you've mentioned earlier, this is what, number four or five consecutive live albums that they've put out? Like, this is getting kind of ridiculous in a sense. I mean, it's almost like, you know, we shouldn't expect, you know, a studio album. We should just expect live albums. I mean, are they going to do a quarantine live album, you know, live from everybody's living rooms, the live quarantine sessions next live, you know? I mean, who knows what will be next on the agenda? I mean, I don't want to make a joke out of it, obviously, because, you know, this quarantine thing is pretty serious. But this whole thing with live records, I understand that maybe the need the record companies sometimes have is they don't want people to forget about a band, so they put out albums and live albums and stuff like that to keep people's interest in the band while they work on other things, right?
Yeah.
But I mean, look, let's face it. Yes have a core audience that are going to buy their things, right? Yeah. The chances of them getting, you know, thousands of brand new fans at this point in their career, I don't know if it'll happen. But, you know, do they really need to put out another live album? I think fans would gladly wait another 6-7 months. And now that they have so much time being at home, they could do a studio record. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. And interesting that it's going to be a inverted commas, proper Roger Dean cover. So presumably that means that the Gottlieb brothers will be involved again, and they'll put together a beautiful package like the Yes 50 Live, which is a stunning, stunning piece of work. And the recordings on that are very good, and the performances are very good. Everything about it, very, very positive and lovely to have. But I can't, you know, I'm agreeing with you, really, that what's going to be different about this live record is that, I mean, okay, they're going to play Gates. They're going to presumably have Gates as one of the songs on it. But, you know, another, not another copy of Roundabout.
Or Seen All Good People.
Yeah. If it had been a dramatically different set of songs that they played on the Royal Affair tour, then of course I'd be delighted to have it. But there's not going to be that much different, is there really?
No, I don't think there's going to be that much of a difference at all. I mean, having seen the show and, you know, the set list and knowing what they played on the set list, you know, it was a good show. The performances are really good. You know, at least the show that I saw was fantastic. So I wouldn't have any, you know, complaints or would expect it to be a bad product. And like you said, the Gottlieb brothers are probably going to be involved in it again. So we're going to have a fantastic packaging. There's a lot of things, obviously, to look forward to on it. But again, you know, if you're a diehard Yes fan, you know, you're kind of rolling your eyes and saying another one of these. I mean, you know, if you're one of these people that are getting into Yes only now, which is very rare, I would think.
Yeah.
But if you're getting into Yes kind of late in the game, then maybe you're going to be excited about this. Okay, you know, one of the first Yes albums I'm going to buy since I become a Yes fan. So that's a kind of interesting thing for that person. But a lot of us, you know, this is going to be the fifth, you know, or fourth or fifth live album in a row that we've bought from Yes. You know, we're kind of aching at this point for a studio record. I mean, at least Oliver finally gave us something, you know.
He did, and it's brilliant. And absolutely delighted to see it. And wasn't he great when he came on the show and talked to us about it? So,
absolutely.
I think we're in full agreement there. It's bound to be an absolutely stunning production, and the playing and the performances will be great, and the selection of songs will be slightly different. But do we really need another one? Not sure we do. And wouldn't it be just fabulous if the painting that Roger Dean was doing was actually going to go on the new studio album? That would just be wonderful. Okay. Mm. Right. Well, as always, don't believe us. Have your own thoughts and put them on the show notes for this week's episode. For the moment, thank you very much indeed, Mark.
You're very welcome, Kevin.
Whatever your progressive rock question, the answer is yes.
Just before we go, here's the list of patrons. Yes Music Podcast producers are Jeffrey Cresselius, Preston Frazier, Bill Govier, and Wayne Hall. And half the Yes Music Podcast patrons are Aaron Steelman, Bob Martellotta, Brian Sullivan, Chris Bandini, Craig Estenes, Dave Owen, David Hayden, Lind, David Pannell, Dave Watkinson, Dem, Doug Curran, Fergus Cubbage, Fred Barringer, Jeff Bailey, Jeffrey Mason, Guy de Rome, Henrik Antonsen, H.B. Peterson, Ian M.B., Jamie McQuinn, Ken Fuller, Michael Handahan, Jim, John Cowan, John Holden, John Parry, John Thompson, and Barry Gorski. Continued thanks to Robert and David. If you'd like to join them to help keep the lights on here at YMB Towers, then please do go over to Patreon, patreon.com/yesmusicpodcast, or just click the button on yesmusicpodcast.com. So that's all the time we have this week. Thank you so much for listening once again. We'll be back next week, I do hope, with our thoughts on the John Anderson album. And in the meantime, you can keep up with what we're doing on Facebook, on Twitter, or on Instagram. So until next week, just remember, whatever your progressive rock question, the answer is yes.